You're listening to the Common Fan Podcast, a Husker football podcast for the common fan by the common fan.
Welcome back to the Common Fan Podcast. We are the Common Fans. I am TJ Burkle alongside Matty Owens Sr. and Geoff in Lincoln. Make sure to subscribe to our YouTube channel. That's youtube.com/@commonfangbr. So you can keep up with all the fun, frivolity, and Husker football obsessing of the Common Fans. We can also be found on all the major podcast streaming platforms. Hey, it's grilling season, Common Fans. If you want to do it right, go get some of Nebraska's own certified Piedmontese beef. This premium Nebraska product is raised and grazed in the Nebraska Sandhills. They've got mouth-watering steaks, juicy burgers, tender beef kebabs, and much more. Stop by your local Mercado butcher shop at 30th and Yankee Hill or 84th and Havelock in Lincoln, and also at 162nd and Maple in Omaha. You can also go to cpbeef.com to get certified Piedmontese products shipped right to your front door anywhere across all 50 states. So what are you waiting for, Common Fans? Get to your local Mercado butcher shop or visit cpbeef.com. Certified Piedmontese, powering the Husker football team and powering the Common Fan Podcast. Our guest today is a staff writer for The Athletic, where he covers Nebraska football. He has covered the Huskers for over 30 years, including going way back to his work at the Daily Nebraskan for ESPN, as well as the Omaha World Herald. We are talking about the inestimable Mitch Sherman. Mitch, thank you so much for joining the Common Fans today.
Yeah, it's good to finally be with you guys. I know, TJ, we've talked about this for several weeks and had some unforeseen circumstances within the Nebraska universe that prevented us from getting on Zoom here a few weeks ago. But it's good to do this now that spring practice is going.
Yeah, no doubt. It's awesome to have you. We really appreciate it. It's funny. We kind of had this opening sort of question teed up when you were supposed to come on and record with us the day all the Trev Alberts news broke, but it was going to be about how great everything was going for Husker athletics and how are we allowed to be excited and enjoy it.
Yeah. I do remember that conversation vaguely that we had on that morning of March 13th, a date that will be long remembered at Nebraska as one of the, I mean, I've lived through a lot of crazy days in Nebraska sports, going back to my time as a student at the university. And there has not been one quite like that. I mean, it was not so much the fact that it was filled with news, but just how surprising and shocking that was. And so what a day. I'm sorry if I was like really short with you and saying, hey, at all that I can talk to you or even think about this thing right now. Let's reconvene in a few weeks. But that's kind of the way my brain was going on March 13th.
No worries at all. Obviously, you had a lot to chase down that day. Just so you're aware, in case it comes up again, he has ceased to be like Anakin Skywalker ceased to be Anakin Skywalker and became Darth Vader. See, he has ceased to be Trev, and on this program, he will forevermore be referred to as Trevor Kendall Alberts if he comes up at all. So, just a little background for you on the Common Fan Podcast.
I mean, it's so weird. It's so weird how the view of Trev Alberts around the Nebraska world has changed in such a short period of time. I mean, my time covering Nebraska goes back to his senior year of college, and wow. I met him when he was winning the Butt Kiss Award and, you know, out there sacking Charlie Ward. And I always just kind of had him and have had him in this high place, as far as like the people who I've come in contact with. And then, so to see him ascend to the athletic director position, it was like this destiny happening, and never could have imagined that. I guess I didn't know him well enough. Like, you think you know somebody, and then the next day they're walking out of the stadium saying, sayonara to the people that they've entertained and led for three decades.
It was truly shocking. And it's funny, you know, kind of to your point, if you had asked, if you'd done a poll of Husker Nation on March 12th, I think everyone would have, you know, it would have been overwhelmingly supportive of Trevor I think a huge, you know, widespread belief that he was doing a great job and we were lucky to have him. And boy, that flipped. That was a quick 180 by honestly, like across the board. I was kind of surprised. There wasn't a lot of nuance there. There wasn't a lot of like, well, maybe we should consider this. It was just like a lot of fury and anger, I think, from the fan base, but also I think some disbelief from a lot of the sports media too.
It was, you know, I think there's people in sports media, and I don't necessarily feel like I'm in this category, but there's people in sports media who've been around Nebraska sports for a long time. And I think to some degree, there are people within that group who feel like they played some small role in Trev Albert's ability to rise to the level that he did. Now, nobody was out there putting up, you know, the numbers that he did and lifting weights and putting in the hard work. Nobody believes that, but a lot of people in this state have been cheerleaders for Trev Alberts going back to 1989, 1990. And, you know, from the time that he had this storybook career and fell just short of a national championship and kind of paved the way for Nebraska to win championships in the year after he left. And he came back and was in the locker room in the 94 Orange Bowl. Well, he played in the 94 Orange Bowl. He was in the locker room for the 95 Orange Bowl, which was the 94 season, the year after he was gone. And it was always just this kind of fairy tale thing. Like, yeah, his pro career didn't work out, but people in Nebraska would always defend Trev. And, you know, yeah, he had some things that didn't work out great in his broadcasting career, but people in Nebraska always defended Trev. And yeah, he went to UNO and he was the athletic director and he had to cut the football program and the wrestling program. And, you know, people got really mad about that, but you know, he was Trev Alberts and he's a Nebraska legend. And there were people who continued to defend Trev and you know, see past those things. That's no longer March 13th, I think is, you know, changed that narrative. And in part, it was just because of the way it went down on that day. And the way that things happened, even in like the hours after he left, when he immediately just stepped in at Texas A&M of, you know, this is a former conference rival of Nebraska. I mean, the only thing worse is if he had gone to Texas and, you know, is immediately like acting like this never happened. Like, you know,
right.
Cheering for the Aggies outwardly, like there needs to be a moratorium when you leave in the way that he did and go and take over another program. Like maybe don't get on social media and
right.
And start doing the athletic director thing for a couple of weeks until maybe you had a chance to meet the coaches and the athletes at the new school you're representing. But you know, what's done is done, and Nebraska's moved on. And you know, I think as time passes, well, I don't know, as time passes, how people are going to view him. I mean, certainly I'm not in favor of like any of the crazy suggestions of taking his name off the stadium. I mean, he earned that and he was a great player at Nebraska and always will have been a great player at Nebraska, but his legacy's tainted for sure. As a result of the way that he exited.
Well, no, I think that's pretty reasonable. I think we just don't let him back into the state. Sorry, go ahead, Jeff.
No, I was going to say the same thing. And kind of what you were saying too, TJ, is how people flipped on him just like that. But to Mitch's point, like getting on social media, I almost felt like he was trolling the fan base at that point. And that's just going to leave a bad taste in a lot of people's mouths.
Right. Like Mitch said, just maybe wait a couple of days before you start tweeting Johnny Football and doing all the weird Texas A&M gig'em cheers and swaying back and forth and stuff.
Give us the courtesy of a 10-minute press conference. You don't even have to take questions, but talk about how much Nebraska means to you, how hard the decision was, whatever. It was just sort of like, according to him, the opportunity came along. He didn't apply for it, but they approached him. And then it was kind of like, well, sounds good to me. I'm out of here. And I think it all left a bad taste in everybody's mouth.
Yeah, I don't know that there's really a graceful way to do that. There's a more graceful way to do it than he did it,
yes,
but I don't know that there's a way to exit in that fashion for a parallel move. and have it be viewed by the fans of the school that you left as anything but a betrayal. So he probably knew that. If not outwardly, I think his instincts probably told him that. And he sensed that it was best to just cut the cord in the way that he did and leave and be gone and start the next day at his new place. But, you know, and again, in time, those specifics are going to be forgotten. But the way that, you know, the speed with which all of this happened, I don't think some Nebraskans may never get over that.
Well, he's made his bed. He's got to sleep in it. Now he's probably at a yell squad practice. So he has to live with that. He's got to live with those decisions. So moving forward, where optimism is sky high in Husker Nation about this football team, you know, Mitch, the defense looks poised to be as good as last year, maybe better. There's a lot of reason to hope about the offense, or at least reasons to talk ourselves into believing the offense could be a lot better. You know, I think a Coach Rhule quote in one of your recent stories, Mitch, really got me thinking about the big picture, though. And I think the X factor for weary Husker fans is like turning the corner and turning close losses into close wins. And kind of that memory of the painful losses of recent years is pretty prominent still. And Coach Rhule said in your March 25th story, quote, "What I want to see when the game comes down to 5 minutes in the fourth quarter is that we make one more play," unquote. And I thought that was really interesting. Like what are you seeing from the coaching staff or that the coaching staff is doing to kind of, that's an intangible, right? That's not like we need to improve the run game or we need to tackle better. It's like this weird mental hurdle that seems to have plagued the program over multiple coaching staff, multiple rosters, multiple sets of players, et cetera. What do you like, how do they go about addressing that? What are they doing to sort of tackle that issue?
Well, one, they're acknowledging it. I think that's the first thing, is to recognize that you have a problem when you have a problem. And very early in the Rhule era, you know, I think that he did something of a 180 on the way that he recognized and acknowledged some of the issues that have plagued Nebraska going back long before he arrived. And I think I will, for as long as he's here, and, you know, whether it's just this upward trajectory or more likely, you know, kind of a bit of a roller coaster, just as college sports are today. I think I'll always remember what he said after his first game. And, you know, we can go back to Thursday night in late August in Minneapolis last year, and Nebraska, of course, I don't need to remind you guys, gives that game away with a couple of turnovers late when things appeared to be in hand, and Minnesota makes a couple plays on offense and kicks a walk-off field goal. And there's all of Nebraska, all of the fans who were there, everyone who's watching, most of the players who are walking into that locker room. You know, it's this dread, in part because of the way it ended, but also because it's like Nebraska went through this whole supposed transformation and the same thing happened. And Matt Rhule came into talk to the media about that game. And, you know, he got a couple questions along those lines and he said, hold on. Like, this is my first game. I just got here. That stuff hasn't happened to me. Like, we're okay. We're going to be fine. We're going to attack this like it's a new thing. And a few games later, maybe that night, but a few games later, he made some comments that could not have been more different than that. Like, he talked about having to really dig psychologically into the mindset of the players and the program and just teach Nebraska the basics of how to play winning football, and so much of how to play winning football when you're in the middle of the road as a team. If you're not Alabama, you're not Ohio State, so much of playing winning football is executing in the fourth quarter, executing in the last 5 minutes of a game. And I think at first, you know, he wanted to kind of jump past that and say, no, we're starting fresh. The stuff that happened before doesn't matter. And he came very quickly to realize that it does matter, that it matters to the players who were a part of that. And it matters in the locker room, even to some of the players who weren't a part of it, because they were made a part of the program. And it's like within the DNA of Nebraska football currently, that it doesn't execute at the end of games and it finds ways to lose games. So the fact that he attacked it from a more like grassroots level pretty early in his career, you know, told me a lot of things about Matt Rhule and that he's okay admitting that maybe he didn't have the perfect approach from day one. And he quickly worked to fix that and to you know, go deeper than he probably thought he had to go at the beginning. So that's the first thing, you know, and you continue to see that recognition now. You know, I'll reference Marcus Satterfield just here this week that we're recording this. He did an interview in spring practice on Thursday of this week, and he talked about the need to be able to throw the football, and that they were going to have to do that at the end of games, and Nebraska would continue to be a program that ran the football. That would be part of their bread and butter, but you have to throw it at the end of games. And I wrote about that in a story on The Athletic, you know, about Dylan Raiola and the reason that he's at Nebraska. And, you know, I looked at the end of games last year, and in Nebraska's five close losses, it had the ball with a chance to win in the final minutes of each one of those games. Four of them ended offensively for Nebraska with an interception. So that's not executing. And it's about fixing the problems, you know, that head on. And they've done that with addressing the quarterback situation. So I think that's where it all starts, is recognizing the problem you have, figuring out how to dig down and address that issue and then just attack it. So the process, the wheels are in motion. You know, we'll find out in the fall if Nebraska has the pieces to actually start to correct some of that stuff this year.
I must admit, hearing the $1.4 million man talk about throwing the ball late in the game, you know, the anxiety starts to creep in a little bit, but you know, like maybe against Maryland, we could have just run the ball instead of throwing the ball, but you know,
oh, no doubt.
We'll give him a little, we've decided we're going to try to give him more benefit of the doubt. We're going to give him another chance.
Give him some grace, a little bit of grace.
You know, that specific situation against Maryland is something that Matt Rhule addressed this spring too. And you know, his take on it is not that Nebraska should run the ball and, you know, take the field goal, and, you know, just get out of there with the lead and then let your defense do the job. He wants to be a coach and he wants to run a program that throws a touchdown pass in that situation. And, you know, his comment, to paraphrase him, was good football teams score a touchdown on that play where Chubba Purdy threw an interception. And there were all kinds of reasons why that play didn't work, and maybe all kinds of reasons, I would argue, why that play shouldn't have been called in that spot with that team. But Rhule's point is that they have to be a team that can call that play and be confident it's going to work and have it work every time.
Yeah, I mean, that's great. That's very interesting. The one thing when we're talking about, you know, close games and that being something that we just haven't been able to close, that, and that's been a monkey on our back, so to speak. Closing out games inevitably leads to winning seasons, but not closing out games leads to losing seasons too. And that seems to be something that, you know, over the last few years has been something that's just been out of our realm of possibility. And if you've ever listened to any of our podcasts in the past, and I'm sure you're a pretty good fan and an avid listener, you've probably heard us say that if we just get us to a bowl game, we'll be dancing in the streets, period. It doesn't matter which bowl game it is. Get us there and we'll be happy. You get us to those six wins. That's something that's always eluded us in the past. Let's just say, for instance, that this season, maybe we get to six wins, not immediately, but you know, towards the middle of the season, and we've got a few games still to look at. Does that change the mental aspect of how the players play? Are we going to be playing a little bit differently with house money, or are we going to be running downhill with a head of steam? Or do players even not think about that sort of thing? Are they just so locked in that that's not even something that's even a pressure to them?
Well, there's a lot of older players in the program, and there are guys who made decisions to come back, and you can look at Isaac Gifford and Bryce Benhart kind of at the top of that list. And, you know, there are others, but those two have been invested in this thing for a long time. And I think the fact that they made their announcements together was important. You're going to see both of those guys as leaders this year, on and off the field. And I think the way that they feel about it is, yeah, it absolutely matters, to them and to veterans like them, that Nebraska gets to a bowl game, that it gets to six wins, that they end their careers by ending this unfathomable drought that Nebraska's experiencing right now is in not playing bowl games. And if they feel it, then I think it just seeps on down through the roster. You know, somebody like, you know, let's just say a Dylan Raiola, a freshman. I don't know why he came to mind, but you know, maybe he's an important piece of this thing in some way or another. Or, you know, like Isaiah Nayer, he's a first year transfer, like, who's played at a couple of other programs before this year. You know, you'd think on the surface, somebody like that is probably not going to be all that impacted by Nebraska's recent tortured history, but I think he will. And, you know, I think young players, old players, whether they experienced it or not, when you spend as much time together as they do through an off season, and then through a season, because to get to six wins, you've obviously spent a good chunk of your season together. Like, they'll recognize and understand the importance of it. Maybe not as much as like the four of us sitting here, but they'll know. And you don't need to have 130 guys to whom it means everything in the world to make a bowl game. But I think what you will have is a powerful majority among the players in the locker room that will really value that milestone and that hurdle when and if and when Nebraska reaches it in 2024. So if they get there, yeah, I do think that there's something to be said for the pressure then is released. You know, the coaches aren't going to look at it that way. They're not going to say, all right, we're 6-2. You know, now we're playing with house money. No, that's absolutely not going to be their mindset. But I do think that there's a psychological part of it where you're not still chasing that sixth win. You definitely saw Nebraska play tight at times in November last year because they were sitting at five wins, went into the month sitting at five wins. You have four opportunities to get that sixth win. And, you know, I think if the scenario was different, and maybe they were already at six wins, like let's say Nebraska beats Colorado or it beats Minnesota, and you go into November at 6-2 instead of 5-3, then, you know, maybe they win Michigan State. Maybe they win Wisconsin. Maybe they win Iowa, or a combination of those games, just because they're not staring down that plateau that they've been unable to get on top of for the last 7 years.
So I think that's what I was kind of shooting for there is, once you get to that sixth win, not saying that they just like play with house money and quit trying, but more or less almost like, all right, we got six wins now. That's off our back. What's to say we can't win the conference championship? What's to say that we can't make the playoff now? Almost like an inspiring moment. So I love that you brought that up.
Now yeah, talking, let's put them in the playoff. I mean, it's a 12-team playoff.
So there we go.
There you go. Why not? I mean, forget the six wins. Like, they need to be playing playoff football in December, right? That's the mindset. As soon, and you know, Nebraska fans, as soon as they get there 1 year, and it's like the next year, all right, you got to a bowl game. Now forget about getting to a bowl game. Let's get in the college football playoff.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. Well, Mitch, diving into some personnel talk a little bit. I think Husker fans have definitely seen some good offensive line play over the years, and we appreciate it too. I think the offensive line did a little bit better last year. You know, some might disagree with that, but I think they did. So just looking at those guys, it's an interesting mix. We've got some guys that have been there what seems like forever, and Bryce Benhart, Turner Corcoran, Teddy Prochaska, and we've got some newer guys. Ben Scott's been here 1 year. We got the transfer Micah Mizcua, and now we got Roquan Buckley moving over from defense, who you mentioned as a, you know, in your recent story, as a guy who coaches are really high on. Do you think that that group, that offensive line, can make a jump this year and maybe start taking it to some Big Ten defensive lines a little bit more this fall?
Yeah, I mean, I'd say they made a jump last year. Nebraska was first or second in the league in rushing yardage a year ago. And that's it's a skewed number because what do you do when you can't throw the football? You run it. So you don't necessarily expect – I mean, Michigan could have been first in the league in running if it wanted to. But it had a good quarterback. So they threw the ball and they won a national championship. I don't think anybody's complaining about that. But I do believe, having said that, that Nebraska's offensive line showed a lot of progress a year ago. And I think part of the reason for that is the continuity that you saw with some of those players that you just mentioned, those older players. And then a big part of it also is the fact that they had a consistent message from their position coach. And for as much as people were down on Donovan Raiola in 2022, and, you know, we can go back to December of 2022 when Dylan committed to Ohio State and the old staff was on the way out and it was unclear if Matt Rhule was going to keep anybody from that group. And who would have thought then that Donovan Raiola, fast forward 15 months, would be viewed in the way that he is? I think it's justified, the praise that he's getting internally and externally as an O-line coach. It was a tough situation, a really just like unmanageable situation, I think, for him to walk into in 22 when Frost was on thin ice. And then, of course, was fired early in the season. And you had an offensive coordinator who was kind of a renegade and wanted to do his own thing. And it was unclear whether his message, Mark Whipple's message, was in any way in line with what Mickey Joseph wanted to do offensively and how that meshed with what Donnie Raiola wanted to do with the offensive line. It was a mess, yeah. You know, their offense and the communication. And I think if Mickey had it to do over again and had an opportunity to fire one of his coordinators after one game, after that Oklahoma game, he might have gotten rid of Whipple and just run the offense himself as opposed to Chenander. Now, I mean, the Chenander thing worked because Bill Bush took over the defense and they improved and they simplified and did good things for the rest of the year. But as far as like who was more competent in like meshing with what Nebraska wanted and needed to do in that moment, I don't think there's any question it was more Chenander than it was Whipple. His presence like messed things up, Whipple's did, and made it difficult for Nebraska to have a good, functional, effective offense. And that hurt Donovan Raiola. You look at it now, and he's very much in line with what Matt Rhule wants in an offensive line coach. It's like these two have been coaching together as long as Rhule's been with like Evan Cooper or the guys on his staff who go way back with him, like Satterfield or, some of the others, EJ Barthel, they've got history together, you know, Terrence Knighton, they have a lot of history together. Having said all that about the offensive line coach, yeah, he's got those guys, I think, believing in what he wants to do. Raiola does. And they're better for it. They're better than the sum of their parts as an offensive line for the first time in a long time at Nebraska. And now I think they actually have some pretty good parts too, with Prohaska and Ben Hart as the bookends. Those guys look lean and mean. I would say this to make a stupid rhyme this spring. Teddy's like 305, 310 pounds. I mean, he's 6'10". Like he could be a lot bigger, but he doesn't want to be. He wants to be able to block, you know, an Ohio State pass rusher. And if he's 340, which he would hold just fine, that guy's going to get around him. He might still get around him if Teddy's 305 or 310, but Teddy will have a better chance of getting in front of that guy. Ben Hart, I think has been maligned in his career at Nebraska, but I think he's an NFL prospect as a right tackle right now. Scott, been here just 1 year, but it feels like he's been here about four with the way that he works together with that group. And we'll see what they do at offensive guard. You know, I think that Micah Mazuka, the Florida transfer, is going to slide into one of those spots. I think that Justin Evans Jenkins is a guy who can be a swing guard or a guard slash center and hold down one of the starting spots. And he's somebody who's really improved over the last year with Rule and Raiola in that system. But there is more uncertainty for sure at the guard spots, because Mazuka got off to a bit of a rough start with his transition to Lincoln. He likes to play football, you know, as Rule said when spring opened, and he's a different guy when he gets out there on the practice field than what they saw maybe in winter conditioning and in his first days in Lincoln. But they're not going to put up with him. They need him to be a complete player, a complete piece of the program before they just hand over a starting spot to him. But having seen him and watched him for just a few minutes in the first week of spring practice, when we got to go in and view, he's a big boy. He has an NFL kind of body, and that's what they want at offensive guard. And if they can get him going, which I think they will, then he's going to be a great addition for them up front. And I think that whole line will be better for it. And you know, I think they have a shot to be an offensive line within the Big Ten that is in, like, let's say for sure the top half of the Big Ten. And, you know, that's pretty good. Maybe even, you know, I don't want to say the top third until I see them play, but if they can get to that point where you're like a top six line in the Big Ten, one of the best six with the lineup of schools that are in the conference in 2024, you know, that means that you're giving your team a chance to win.
Yeah. What was the deal with Mazuka? Was he just out of shape, or, you know, tough transition, you know, moving to Lincoln and adjusting to life and good old Lincoln, Nebraska? I must have missed that.
Yeah, he got to Lincoln a little bit late in January, and you know, Rule didn't go into specifics about it, but he was asked about Mazuka, or he may have brought it up preemptively in February when Rule talked to the media on the second signing day, and he just said he's not getting it done right now. And I don't think he necessarily came in out of shape. I think it was similar to what they've seen with Stephon Thompson, the linebacker transfer from Syracuse, where Nebraska puts a big priority on the expectations that are placed on these players away from the season, away from spring practice, away from the 4 months in the fall when they're together and practicing. Like the other 7 months out of the year, there are high expectations on them to do more than, you know, just show up in the morning and lift weights and go through the conditioning. Like they want these guys to be all in every way. And that's just kind of like the Matt Rule way of doing it. Like, that's why I think he's so much better suited to be a college coach than an NFL coach, because NFL guys, you know, they come to the building in the morning, they do their job and they go home. They've got families or whatever they do from, you know, the time that they're not in football. And as an NFL coach, I think you just kind of have to deal with that. He wants these college guys. Now don't get me wrong, they don't spend as much time in the facility necessarily as NFL players. It's not technically their full-time job, although, you know, it is. He just wants them to be, you know, like bought into the college experience. And you know, we've seen all these examples through Rule's time at Nebraska of the players getting together and, you know, going to a tennis match or going to, you know, support a teammate who's wrestling, like with Nash this winter. And if you're new to the program and you come in as a transfer, maybe it's difficult to grasp that right away. And if you don't grasp that, and maybe like you're giving them some attitude about some of these extracurricular things that Nebraska wants you to do and expects you to do, well, then immediately like your profile, it has gone down in the eyes of these coaches. Like, they're not just going to put up with that and say, okay, well, he played at Florida last year. You know, he's a future NFL draft pick. Like, we're just going to let him slack and not be a part of this team in the way that we expect from the other guys. It's like, no, you either get up to speed or you're in the doghouse. And for some time at Nebraska, and maybe still a couple of these transfers, at least a couple of them, two that have come up in public settings when Rule talked, are having a rough time like grasping that expectation that's placed on them.
Wow. I mean, well, it's certainly good to hold them to that standard and that expectation. I think it just in the long run, I think it'll definitely benefit the program. So,
right, you can't have a double standard, and we've seen that in the past at Nebraska with some players. Maybe you're a star recruit, and you come in, and you know you don't like to work as hard in practice or put in the time in the weight room, you know. But the coaches know that you can go out and you're capable of running for 100 yards, you know, without you know much effort, and they let that slide, and that's a bad precedent to set, and we've seen it at times, and I think we've seen it hurt the chemistry, the overall like fabric of the entire program, and sure. You know, Rule's pretty dead set on not allowing that to be the case.
Yeah, I mean, you said it too. I mean, he's embraced the college culture, and he's quite possibly the opposite of an NFL coach. Events. His presence on social media is pretty awesome too. So he's done a great job, which kind of leads me to another question was, you talked to Nebraska defensive coordinator, Tony White, shortly before spring ball. And he shared some pretty revealing things about what kind of leader Matt Rhule is. You mind sharing some of those with us, or more importantly, what did that tell you about Coach Rhule?
It validated what I thought I already knew. And one great thing about Matt Rhule is he allows people like me, you know, if I'm interested and I am in getting to know him, you know, not all of it like turns into an article that I write. Right. But, it allows me to kind of have that lens into who he is like about it. He likes to talk about his kids and his wife and what they're doing. And, you know, it lets you know what you're dealing with as a person. And then for me, the benefit there, it's not because I want to rub elbows with the head coach and like feel privileged. It's because there are going to be stories that come up. If he stays here and has success, people who read my stuff, who listen to me talk, are going to want to, or they're going to look to me for insight about who Matt Rhule is. And, you know, I'll be able to, because I've gotten to know him in his first year, I'll be able to provide that on a level that I think the Nebraska fans will be excited about. So because I had some of those conversations with him, you know, outside of the camera, outside of the press conference setting, what Tony White told me before spring practice didn't come as a surprise to me. Maybe it did to some others who, you know, not everybody, of course, has had the chance to get to sit down with Matt Rhule. And I understand that. So that's why, you know, it was important to me to put that stuff in print from Tony. But, you know, Tony, he was really moved by the fact that Matt Rhule went to bat for him in December, and even again in, what was it, February, when Tony's name came up initially for some jobs that came open in the first part of this coaching cycle, like Syracuse was open, San Diego State was open. And these are schools that Tony has coached at. It seemed, for whatever reason, like every school that he's ever had an affiliation with had a job opening in this coaching
every carousel. Week it felt like.
Yeah. And then again, when Chip Kelly stepped aside at UCLA, and you know, he played there. He played there and he got his start in coaching there. That's where he met Matt Rhule, was at UCLA. So Rhule again went to bat for Tony in what would have been a really, really difficult time to lose your defensive coordinator. That was late in the cycle. You know, Chip Kelly didn't get fired. He stepped down to be the offensive coordinator at Ohio State. And what was, you know, as you think back on that, it's like, so the UCLA head coach stepped down to go be the offensive coordinator at Ohio State. How motivated is Ohio State to get past this Michigan stuff that's been going on? Right. Well, they hired the UCLA head coach to be their OC and got him to do it. Not just any UCLA head coach, but the former Oregon head coach, the former Philadelphia Eagles head coach. So that happened, and immediately Tony's name starts to come up for that thing. And Rhule, you know, doesn't blink. Same answer that he gave in January, like, whoever hires Tony White as a head coach is going to be happy that they did that years from now, because he's going to make an outstanding head coach. And we want to keep him here as the DC, but whenever he gets that opportunity, you know, this is Matt Rhule talking, I'm behind him. I will make phone calls. I will. And he said it, and he actually did some of that stuff. And he called athletic directors and said, hire Tony White. And Tony knew this and was so grateful, as I think anyone would be in that situation. He had here's Tony. He coached with Matt Rhule for 1 year. Yeah, they met each other back at UCLA 20 years ago, but they didn't coach together then. Tony was out of the program. He was just kind of, he was around as a former player, and Matt was coming in as a GA. It was a totally different kind of dynamic than what they shared in 2023 with Rhule as the head coach and Tony as the DC. So they've been together 1 year, and here's Rhule, you know, standing up on a chair for this guy, talking to anybody who would listen, making phone calls, you know, trying to get Tony a job, when the best thing that happened for Nebraska football in Rhule's first year was the implementation of Tony White's defense. And everybody, I think, understands that if you pulled the rug on that, yeah, there's good defensive assistants who could have stepped up. And I have no doubt that he would have promoted one of those guys to be the defensive coordinator. And I think there's a chance that any and all of those three defensive position coaches will become defensive coordinators at some point in their career, if they choose that path. You know, I don't know if Evan Cooper will choose that path, because he's so talented as an evaluator and, you know, a recruiter. Like, it's maybe best to keep him in a role where he's not scheming a defense, but he's recruiting a team. They're all immensely talented as position coaches, but it still would have been a huge loss for Nebraska if Tony had left to go anywhere. And Rhule was willing to sacrifice that to get his guy a promotion. So that was the, you know, I think that's what you're getting at with the question. That was the gist of Tony's comments about Matt Rhule. He said that he'd never had anybody that he worked with. And there were some coaches who he'd worked with for a decade or longer, but he'd never had anyone who he worked with that went to bat for him in the way that Matt Rhule did in December through February of this last year.
Right. And that's certainly going to get guys to be loyal to you, right? Like you're mm-hmm. when you're doing that, like you said, you're standing on a chair and stumping for somebody when it's going to hurt you, but you're willing to, you know, help them further advance their career. That says a lot. Speaking about Coach White, you had a couple of quotes in a couple of your recent articles that I think will definitely have some Husker fans frothing at the mouth. The one where he asked his assistants, you know, quote, are we any good? Which I love. And then this one a little bit longer, but, kind of piggybacking on what you just said, how he said, quote, there is no head coach talk. Anybody who mentions that to me, there is no such thing. If we do a good enough job and somebody wants my profile, then that will come. But everything goes away if you don't produce. There is no anything. Right now, I'm the shittiest defensive coordinator in the country, unquote. We love that. And we love how Coach White had the defense playing last year. Can he somehow get them to take it to another level this year, in your opinion?
Yeah, I think so. I think there's a reason to temper the excitement a bit because of the schedule that Nebraska played in 23 and what it is in 24. It's not a murderer's row in 24 necessarily, especially in the first half of the year, which is good. When you're doing some rebuilding and replacing pieces like they are with Luke Reimer and Nick Henrich and Quentin Newsome. But, the lineup of offenses that Nebraska faced in 23, you know, with the Big Ten West and, you know, Colorado being the one exception. I mean, Michigan had a good offense, but Michigan's MO against Nebraska was not to score 60 points and put up 600 yards. It was to win in the way that Jim Harbaugh built that team to win, with defense and you know, just grind you down offensively. So I think some of the numbers were a bit skewed. I don't know that Nebraska had like the sixth or seventh best defense in the country in 2023, like the stats might show. I think if you dump Nebraska into the Big 12 or the SEC, like the numbers would have looked different last year, but they still made a ton of improvement. They still, in year over year from the previous season, it was what they did schematically, just like the competence of the defense to see them run to the ball from the first game of the year when Nebraska played at Minnesota. And, you know, even like the first or second series of the year, you could see a difference in the way that they attacked and the confusion that they created for an opposing quarterback. Even, you know, it didn't happen with JJ McCarthy, but they knew Nebraska's signals, so why would it? But seasoned quarterbacks had a really hard time, you know, just understanding what Nebraska did defensively. And I think it was Daniel Kalin, who this week in his first interview as a Nebraska player, he mentioned in practice how you never see the same coverage two plays in a row from the defense, and just like what an incredible adjustment that was for him coming out of high school. You imagine being a kid who played, you know, at Bellevue West, and you know, you're going up against teams from the Metro Conference in Omaha, and then you walk into spring practice like 3 months later and Tony White's defense, you know, is sending like, zone blitzes and all kind, you know, a three man front that looks like a five man front. And then a six man defensive backfield that suddenly morphs into like a four linebacker look. It's gotta be difficult. And so I appreciated that Danny brought that up, and it just kind of goes back and sheds light on what Nebraska does schematically as a defense, and just how effective that can be. So yeah, I think in 24, while they did lose some key pieces, I counted up the other day, and of the returning players, there's 11 who have started three games or more. 10 of them started three games or more last year. And then Marquise Buford started two games last year, but had started in previous years. He was hurt for most of 23. So just had the two starts at the end of the season. That's a lot of experience, and they're old up front with Robinson and with Nash Hutmacher and with Jamari Butler. I think they're strong in the secondary. They're good at the safety spot. I think they're going to be really good at what I consider like the two most important positions, maybe not the most important, but like the two positions that can take this scheme for Nebraska from being like an effective defense to a great defense. To me, are the Jack position, that linebacker that's like a hybrid between the set first level and the second level, and then the nickel position that Isaac Gifford plays, which is kind of the same thing on a hybrid, but between the secondary and the linebacker spot. Like those to me are the spots that just like clean up all the messes, that make the splash plays, that are going to generate turnovers for Nebraska. And that's a big place that it wants to improve. And Tony is intent on getting Nebraska to improve is in creating turnovers. And I think when the guys understand the defense just a little bit more in year two, then they start to get freed up a little bit to make some of those plays that lead to turnovers. And, you know, that's the hope for Nebraska, that it picks up where it left off, and then it's able to take it up a couple of notches in just a few areas, getting after the quarterback, you know, being more diverse up front, with, you know, the packages, you know, being like they could legitimately be eight or nine players deep on the defensive line, and then just, you know, finding ways to cause havoc and create turnovers. We saw a lot of havoc last year. We didn't see as many turnovers as they would have liked. So they know where they want to get better. I think they know how they want to do it. And it'll be a matter over the next four or five months of like getting the chemistry together, getting the pieces together on the field, finding the right mix of leadership, so that they can actually go out and do that. And, you know, all the coaches are still there. All the guidance that they're going to get in the meeting room, on the practice field, is all the same. So it stands to reason, you know, that they have talent that's equal to or better than what was a year ago. And they should get to that place that people want with them to be a very good defense in his second year.
Love it.
Woo! Ready for that. Yeah. Your piece on April 3rd, Mitch, focused on 10 Huskers who have your attention, other than the quarterback position. Who's the most intriguing player on that list for you?
I might actually go with Nash. I don't have the list in front of me. You know, I know I mentioned Gifford. I know I mentioned James Williams. You know, and it wasn't, I didn't mention all of them for positive reasons. It was, you know, 10 players have my interest. Like some have my interest because I'm looking at them and like, well, is this going to work? And I think I put Stephon Thompson on that list for that reason. I think Stephon Thompson's a guy that can fit into the starting lineup as a linebacker. If not, like, you know, he's one of the first 11 out there. He's definitely like in the rotation and somebody that they have that could put in on the first series or the second series of the game. I think he can be that kind of player, but I'm intrigued and I want to, he has my interest because of what we heard from Tony White and from Matt Rhule at the start of spring practice here about how, you know, he didn't come in as that ready-made player. But yeah, I mean, I look at Nash and, you know, I think he has the ability to like transcend, you know, just the player that we see out there on the field. Like when Nash was coming out of high school in the middle of South Dakota, like rural South Dakota, I drove up there, and, you know, interviewed him and went to his high school and talked to his wrestling coach and his football coach and his dad. And, you know, it was very evident that he had this aura about him that was bigger than even the great wrestler that he was or the dominant football player that he was. People looked at him in a way to inspire confidence. He's got something about his personality, a little bit of just like quiet swag to him. He certainly did in high school. And then he came to Nebraska and it's like he's thrown into a much bigger pond and it took him some time to like find his place and figure out like how to become that person, or, you know, how to bring that, he's always that person, but like how to bring those traits again out of his personality, like how to do it in this environment that's way different than Chamberlain, South Dakota. And it started to happen last year when he went to work with Terrence Knighton and Tony White in that defense and had his partner Ty Robinson alongside him. And I think he fit well into the scheme that Tony White brought. And, you know, you could just kind of tell like Nash made big plays in big moments. And, you know, he would bust into the backfield and tackle a running back. And I think the fans in the stadium like felt it too. Like it's the polar bear, you know, he's wreaking havoc in the backfield. And it's like, we haven't had that feeling about a defensive lineman at Nebraska in quite some time. I mean, he's not Ndamukong Suh. Nobody is, but like, those are the kind you saw Nash flash a few moments where it was like, man, I haven't seen somebody do that at Nebraska since Suh. I mean, Randy Gregory came after him, but he's a different kind of player. I mean, Randy Gregory's like, you know, still doing it in the NFL. And he's just, you know, 6'5", like chasing quarterback. That's not Nash. I mean, Nash is just like pushing people backwards and, you know, engulfing running backs, you know, before they can get to the line of scrimmage. And when you have a defensive lineman like that, like a guy who can play the nose position and win battles, that just gives a completely different element to your defense. And I think he's capable of that. And just what he did here this winter to go and say, you know, I'm going to go wrestle and I'm going to lose 45 pounds and make weight at 285 and go out and compete in this sport that I haven't competed in 4 years and like actually do pretty well, like make the NCAA championships and the way that the players, his teammates rallied around him. I was there when he wrestled his first match as a collegiate wrestler at the Devaney Center in January. And like the team was off on that day, you know, they were out for break, semester break, and still a ton of them were there cheering him on. And like the reception that he got from his teammates after he won, he pinned his guy. I think it was the only pin he had all season. But he's got that flair for the dramatic and he pinned his guy and he came off the mat and met up with his football teammates back in the locker room. Like, I see them rallying around him. I see them looking to him as a defensive player who can, again, inspire confidence within the black shirts in kind of the same way that he did back when he was in high school. So he's definitely got my interest for that reason. So I'm excited to see, you know, you plug him in and he's 310 pounds and able to move at a different and, you know, move differently than he did when he was 330 last year. You know, I think he can, you know, I think again, he's not Sue. He's probably not an All-American, but he's a very, very good player within the Nebraska defensive system.
Love it. On the opposite side of the ball, we do seriously try and not talk about Dylan Raiola all the time on this podcast.
You should talk about him all the time.
It's hard not
feed,
to.
Feed the monster. It'll help your podcast.
Yeah, that's right. That's right.
Get the subscribers up. Having said that, I am going to ask you a Dylan Raiola question. He did speak to the media for the first time. So what's your overall assessment of the quarterback situation as a whole? And I guess most importantly, how many records is Dylan going to break for us this year?
Well, the records are pretty high. I mean, Nebraska's had some, hasn't necessarily had like championship caliber teams over the last few years or the last like 15, 20 years. But what they have had are quarterbacks who've been productive and thrown for yards and maybe not been clutch. And I don't think that's not necessarily what Nebraska has to look for in Dylan. They don't need Dylan to go out and like break Taylor Martinez or Adrian Martinez records. Like those guys can have the yards if Dylan makes the touchdown throws in the fourth quarter of games. And I don't even know that Matt Rhule and the Satterfield, Glenn Thomas offense necessarily is conducive to Dylan Raiola like becoming the record holder in everything for Nebraska. I don't know that he's going to go out and he could be a first round pick and he still might not go out and throw for as many yards as Joe Gans did in 2007, just because that was a different team. This is a team that's going to play complementary football if they're doing it the way that their coaches draw it up in the meeting rooms. So I will look for him to be, and we'll see if he can do it this year, but I look for him to be like poised, a steady presence, somebody who relies and leans on the training that he has received both before his time at Nebraska. I mean, he's somebody who's been groomed to be a quarterback since he was a little kid. And, you know, his dad playing center in the NFL for 14 years and having relationships with quarterbacks like Matthew Stafford and John Kitna and others. You know, they weren't winning teams for the Detroit Lions, but they did have some quarterbacks who were able to teach Dominic's kids a thing or two about playing that position and how to handle yourself, how to hold up your head, how to lead a group of teammates. You know, one thing that Dominic did was he really just had to him, because he was a center, the quarterbacks were part of his family, and they would bring those quarterbacks into their homes. And, you know, for the latter part of Dominic's career, he was older than them. So, you know, he had his kids and they didn't necessarily have, the quarterbacks didn't have their own families yet. And they became part of the Raiola family and like uncles to Dylan and his younger brother Dayton. So he picked up a lot there about what it means to be a quarterback. And, you know, if he can combine that with the training that he's received here in the last couple of years since he blossomed as a five-star prospect, and then mix that with what he's able to pick up from Glenn Thomas, you know, who's coached his own list of strong quarterbacks like Matt Ryan when he was with the Atlanta Falcons. You know, you kind of put all that together, and you know, if Dylan can become the product of his environment, then, you know, I think that would lead him to be able to do all the things that Nebraska needs as a quarterback. You know, my read on it right now, where they're at, is they're doing everything they can, Nebraska as a program, to kind of take the weight off of his shoulders. You know, there's no talk about him being QB1 or when they're going to, you know, to name a starting quarterback. You know, right now there's multiple reasons, but it certainly serves them well with this quarterback situation to have broken the team up into these three teams, the Nebraska Spring League that they've concocted. I've never heard of anything like this. That's not something that Nebraska's done in spring practice before, but they have three teams. Well, there's three quarterbacks, so they have three teams. So each one of them is like equal billing. And I'm not saying that they're doing this entirely for the quarterbacks. I think part of the reason they're doing it is because they just want to infuse competition into everything that is going on in the program right now. And that's part of how they get over the hump of learning to win and learning to succeed in pressure situations is just compete at everything you do. So they compete in practice, and it plays into the situation well at quarterback, because each one of these guys right now, Daniel Kalen, Heinrich Harburg, and Dylan Raiola, has a team to lead. So they don't have to like worry about, well, who's getting the reps with the ones? Yeah, there's still a team period where they do all that stuff, a full team period. But for a good portion of practice, you're off leading your little spring league team. So you're not thinking about that stuff. Like, hey, I'm running with, I got 12 snaps with the one today, and this guy over here got 22. Like, you got other stuff to worry about. And that's kind of a, you know, it's kind of a brilliant move on the part of the coaches to have taken some of that pressure off of him at this moment. As a freshman, you don't want him to have that kind of pressure. Going into his sophomore year, sure, you know, heap all the pressure you want. If he goes out and he's the starter for 13 games this season, and he shows the promise that they expect him to be able to show, well, then in year two, you take the reins off and it's his show. That's when he's a Heisman candidate, whatever, you know, according to the grand yes. plan. But that's not year one, man. That's year one is like, let the players around you help bring you along and help you win. That's very much the, the vibe I'm getting out of camp right now, you know, all of like five or six practices into this thing.
Awesome. Well, Mitch, you've been extremely generous with your time. But I did have to ask one question to you. I'm a guy who's just completely obsessed with stadiums, college football stadiums, MLB stadiums, NFL stadiums. We've got four new ones in the Big Ten this year, with the Pac-12 schools that are joining the Big Ten. Which mm-hmm. of those are you most excited to visit?
Ooh, great question. I've been to all of them except for Outson Stadium at Oregon. So I'd say, you know, just from that perspective, I can't wait to get to Eugene and see a game there. I was at ESPN when Nebraska played there, and my area of coverage was like, you know, the Big 12 or the Big 10. I don't know what I was doing that year, but it wasn't like just following Nebraska around the country like I'm doing with The Athletic or like I did with the Omaha World Herald. So I missed that trip out to Eugene when Nebraska went out there a few years ago. Been to the Rose Bowl several times, been to the Coliseum, been to Husky Stadium a couple times in Seattle. Those are all great venues. I mean, the Rose Bowl is like the coolest venue in all of college football. A little different for a UCLA game than it is for a Rose Bowl on New Year's Day. But I'm most excited to get to Outson. Of the four teams that are coming in, they're the one in the best position right now to compete for college football playoff berths. Not to say that USC couldn't get there like in the blink of an eye. I mean, all it takes is like, you know, Lincoln Riley to replace Caleb Williams and whatever, fix the defense a little bit and 12 team playoff. Like, yeah, they could be there this year, but Oregon is primed like to be a favorite to be in the playoff this year. And of course they're not on Nebraska's schedule in year one of this new expanded Big Ten. But, you know, if you're just asking me which one I'm excited to go to, all of them, but Outson for sure, because I've not been there.
Awesome. Awesome. Well, I know TJ's been there. I've only been to the Coliseum, and it's fine. I mean, it's a historical mm-hmm. historical place, but I'd love to go to all the other three that I haven't been to. I just love stadiums.
Definitely the least impressive as far as like the surroundings of the stadium. Like the Coliseum is cool in itself, like walking into that facility and seeing the history there, you know, with the Olympics having been staged there. But you go outside of the Coliseum and it's nothing like being at Husky Stadium or being at the Rose Bowl.
My wife is an Oregon Duck, actually, so I've been to Autzen a few times. It's a pretty cool I mean, Eugene's a cool town and Autzen's a cool stadium. So I think you'll enjoy that one too.
Yeah. Can't wait to get to all those places.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, Mitch, thank you so much for joining us today. Common fans, check out all of his great work at The Athletic. Subscribe to The Athletic to continue to feed the addiction. Mitch, any final thoughts for the Common fans?
No, I mean, I think we covered everything. Thank you guys for having me on, and I'm glad we finally got to do this. It was fun to talk and you know, start to think about things that go beyond like the next spring practice and talk about the fall. I think it's going to be an exciting year too for Matt Rhule. You know, it'll be full of intrigue and there'll be dramatic moments. If that's one thing that Nebraska football has continued to give us over the years, even with its struggles, is you know, reasons to stay tuned in. So that's the main thing that I care about. But I'm along for the ride with everybody, and it would be nice to have a place to go that's sunny and warm in the end of December or early January this year.
Absolutely. Yeah. Sick. Give us to a bowl game. We're dancing in the streets, baby.
That's right.
Thanks so much, Mitch Sherman. We'll be back at you soon, Common fans. As always, GBR for life.